When discussions turn to the wild social excesses of the 1920s, the jazz age or the roaring 20s, pick your phrase, F. Scott Fitzgerald often comes up. He created The Great Gatsby and in some ways lived Gatsby's life. Fitzgerald never met Henrietta Bingham, but it's possible she could have drank him under the table and danced him off the floor. By now you say, who? Henrietta Bingham of the Louisville Binghams, longtime owners of the Courier Journal and several broadcasting outlets. She is the focus of a new biography called Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. Emily Bingham is the woman who chose to write the biography. She's related to Henrietta. She's the great-niece of Henrietta. Emily has published a couple of books before this one. She teaches frequently at Center College in Danville, Kentucky, and lives in the traditional family seat of Louisville. So, Emily Bingham, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey.
It's good to have you here. Did your family know or talk much of Henrietta while you were growing up?
Not to me. And I think therein lies the seed, I suppose, of the book, because it was the contrast between they're not talking about her to me and then the stories that I began to hear as an adult that seemed just, you know, really just didn't add up. Why she wasn't talked about and then why, you know, that she was spending the 20s in London with the Bloomsbury Group and things like that just didn't make sense. But all I knew was that she owned a horse farm outside of Louisville sometime in the 30s, 40s, I didn't know when, and that she was a great horsewoman, and I thought that was great. I liked horses too. But there was a picture of her barn, and that was the main representation of her in my life growing up. And then she was known, apparently, whenever her name did come up, my father would tell a quick story, and then the conversation would change. And the story was that Henrietta, if you looked the wrong way, she would steal the bacon out of your BLT.
That's quite a reputation to have in the family.
So I really knew so little, and it was only later as I got older. There was a rumor I remember hearing as a teenager that she grew and smoked marijuana. that seemed interesting at the time. I think it really arose from the fact that she farmed hemp for the war effort. But in those days, marijuana and hemp, as they kind of are today, classified the same. So that was one, but it really was my interview in my 20s with my my grandmother. This is Henrietta Bingham's sister-in-law. Henrietta's younger brother married my grandmother. And she, just in the course of telling me about her own life, said of Henrietta that she was incredibly dazzling and extraordinarily sophisticated to this younger woman, but that she was, you know, an invert.
An invert. Interesting. And did you explore what that term meant?
Well, I was sort of, it was one of those moments where it was just a bit stunning. I'd never heard the word, but the way it was said sort of conveyed very clearly that this had to do with non-conforming sexuality in some way. And I later looked that word up, this sort of sat there. It was in the course of 20 hours of oral interviews with my grandmother, and it just sat there in my mind as this sort of painful word, and I later found that it was more commonly used word to describe homosexuality in the sort of 1890s turn of the century, a pre-Freudian word, really.
Interesting, a term just to sort of label somebody and figure out that there was what they thought then was a disease and try to deal with it on that basis. So you've learned a lot from your she was your grandfather's sister, so you learned about it from his wife. Now you were, I guess, 3 years old when she died. Do you know if you ever met her?
I don't know that I ever did. By the last few years of her life, she wasn't traveling much, and honestly, I know even earlier than that, sometimes her approach to a family event was not always anticipated with joy, because sometimes she just wasn't dependable and always a good guest, from what I later learned. But I'm not sure if she came. I don't think she came to my christening, and there really weren't many occasions. She was living in Manhattan then, as she had really through the 50s and 60s, and it had been a long time since she'd been based in Kentucky by that point.
Now, Emily, you named your daughter after Henrietta Bingham, didn't you?
Right. So then what happened is, you know, the invert comment just sat there. And as I got more interested in, I was a graduate student in history and studying women's lives. I mean, I began to read more about lives of women in the 20th century. But it wasn't until I was myself back in Kentucky and having children, and we were looking for a name. I had a second child coming. We run through a lot of names thinking about the first one. And my favorite, the top choice, was Sophie, but it was 1998, and I think I got three or four birth announcements with Sophie on them, and I thought, I'm not going to do that to her. So we kept digging around, and these Victorian names were just so appealing, and we thought, well, why not Henrietta? And she was obviously a brave and interesting person, if not always a happy one. And why not? So that was when things really turned. It was in the years after my child's birth, Henrietta, that people started emerging from the woodwork with just the strangest stories, the most unbelievable ancient gossip, these almost petrified sort of pieces of memorabilia, whether they were beautiful cigarette cases with diamond edging or a few letters and photographs, and even some linen sheets came my way with her monogram. And it was the stories that came with those things that really began to make me feel that she was tapping on my shoulder.
Okay. And did some of the stories have a grain of truth, or were like a majority of them fake?
There seemed to be a grain of truth to many of them, and they certainly, some of them seemed like legend, but there was one that I was told early on by an older woman in Louisville.
Hold the thought there. We'll pick it up on the other side of a break. I want to get to that story. Older woman from Louisville. The book is Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. Her grandniece, Emily Bingham, wrote the book, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll come back and talk more about Henrietta with Emily when we return to the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about Henrietta Bingham. And before you say who, I can answer that question, but it's a little more complicated than it sounds like. She is a would-be publishing heiress, was back in the 1920s when she was in her 20s. What a great time to be that. Really a jazz age, jet set kind of figure, even before there were jets. A book about her is called Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham, written by her grandniece, Emily Bingham, who is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Questions or comments are welcome at 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. So you talked about all these stories, Emily, that came forward over time. With a grain of truth to many of them, and one in particular you were starting to cite from some elderly woman in Louisville.
Yes, she wasn't too elderly then, but that was 15 years ago. So now, and it was soon after my Henrietta was born, and so the name was sort of on the lips, and I was at a dinner with her, and she said, "How are you? How are your children?" That's the way all the conversations start once you have children, it seems. And I said, "Fine." He said, "Oh, well, Henrietta, my mother told me that she was arriving at a debut party back in the 20s or early 30s. She was taking off her fur with everybody else down in the foyer, handing it over to the coat check, and this disturbance erupted above at the top of this grand staircase that everyone was going up to the party, and another debutante came streaking out of the powder room and said over the staircase to the assembled people coming in, 'Henrietta Bingham just kissed me on the lips.'" And so this is the kind of thing that I just was thinking, my gosh, there's actually a memory of a kiss. We don't hear this when we write history very much. And you can make this up, it's in fiction, but to actually be able to trace the physical actions and effects, as they were impressively in Henrietta's case, on other people is just a wild and unusual circumstance.
That really is. I mean, a story like that to survive for that many generations. But this is a different segment of society than many of us are used to, a real one percenter kind of family. I mean, we have, and you provide a family tree, which is really helpful because you got Binghams and Stenhouses and Flaglers. And so given the money in the family, did Henrietta ever have to work?
No, she didn't really. And, you know, there was great sort of freedom and privilege to that, clearly. But it also meant, I mean, her life came with a great deal of public sort of scrutiny. I mean, people were aware of her. She couldn't really be easily under the radar, put it that way. So, no, but she was living in a time where opportunities for women, not, you know, to work, but also to have more of a public role were increasing. And the progressive era had seen a lot of women doing voluntary work that you know, affected our cities and governments. But more women were actually going into work. And interestingly, she and her younger brother, my grandfather, wrote a play, which they never quite finished, but it's fairly fully conceived. And in it, it's a very autobiographical play called Shadows. And in it, the elder daughter, very much the Henrietta character, is a very ambitious businesswoman. And so she could even conceive herself that way. Now, in the story, the father in the family squelches his daughter's ambitions and business career in order to keep her near him. And this is very much also Henrietta's story, as a balance between her own ambitions and her own efforts to find home and happiness and love with her duty and the expectations of a very domineering and ambitious man.
So, an unusual woman for her time, certainly. And boy, she was born in 1901, wasn't she? So she really was in her 20s, in the roaring 20s.
I mean, she hit that wave. I'm not a surfer, but if I were, I think I would know what it felt like to hit a wave just right, because she was able to ride it out about as long as it went. But we forget that wave didn't go on forever. So the openness around women's roles changing, the interest in and sort of tolerance for sexual experimentation, both heterosexual and beyond, were very much roiling at that moment. And it didn't last. She sure outlasted it, and she and many, many, many others like her were, you know, subject to the you know, censure of society when people's views became less open. But before that happened, she made cut quite a swath, I would say, and she had relationships that were meaningful and powerful with a number of people from the athletic world, you know, the top tennis players in the country, to producers, actors, actresses, people like John Houseman, sculptors, artists on two sides of the Atlantic. And no one who knew her that way ever forgot her.
Indeed. The book is called Irrepressible: The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham. Emily Bingham, her grandniece, wrote the book. Here on the Jefferson Exchange, we're talking to Emily. You say the book is not a rescue operation, Emily. How so?
Well, I didn't feel that Henrietta was a victim who was crying out for help. I didn't feel that anyone should feel pity for her. And some biographies, I think, you know, take someone who's experienced terrible things and tries to restore them and, you know, show us the terrible things that happened to them. Henrietta was powerful in her own time and even when the world wasn't going her way. And I wanted to try to convey and recapture some of that power, not simply throw her a lifeline.
So the sleuthing you had to do to learn more about her, because you ran into a fair number of tight lips around the family, it sounds like there was some almost physical digging here.
Yes, spade work, for sure. Yes. And, you know, what that means for me as an historian is mainly, you know, looking into books, looking into people's archives. And I did quickly, not fairly quickly, find Henrietta written into the indexes of various books. Now, fortunately for me, her intersection in London in the 1920s with a number of members of what is known now as the Bloomsbury Group was a really good fortune, because they wrote so many letters and kept so many diaries and wrote so many memoirs even later. Now, this is the group that formed around Virginia Woolf and her sister Vanessa Bell and their brother Toby, who died young, but his friends from Cambridge, like Lytton Strachey and John Maynard Keynes and on, Leonard Woolf, created an intellectual and cultural coterie that embraced Henrietta in the early 20s as an exotic jazz age Kentucky princess. And it just was really lucky that I could sort of see her when I dug a lot. I could see her through their letters and notes to each other and memoirs. One memoir described her in a party in 1923, gathering a circle around her as the music wound down and picking up a mandolin and starting to sing a chain gang song. And this was just beyond. I mean, this is before Josephine Baker. This is before hardly any African-American musicians were really known in Europe. And she was bringing their music to this group of intellectuals, and they'd never seen anything like it. Two of them fell in love with her that night.
A lot of people fell in love with her, as we find out as we go through the book. The book is called Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham, written by her great niece, Emily Bingham. Emily's our guest on The Exchange. You can join us as we talk about Henrietta. 800-838-3760 around the region. And email address jx@jeffnet.org. Jeannie in Medford dropped off a question, wants to ask about Zelda Fitzgerald and similarities between Zelda and Henrietta. They were both Southern Belles.
Yes, indeed. And I think both carried that sort of ambition that that a certain generation of even Southern women was able to express. Obviously, Zelda connected herself to a powerful and ambitious man, and Henrietta chose not to do that. And both of them definitely struggled with emotional and substance abuse. So later in life, Zelda, as we know, really spiraled downward. And Henrietta, also, though she did last longer and was never long-term incarcerated or, I guess, put into a mental hospital the way Zelda was, but she had her breakdowns as well. And I actually saw some very moving parallels between what F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote about his own crack-up and breakdowns in his later years to what Henrietta experienced, looking back and trying to recapture, I'm sure, some of the verve that had animated her and everyone around her in the 20s that just, you know, wasn't going to happen by 1950 or so. So there are some great parallels there, and I would encourage anyone who's interested in Zelda to take a look at Henrietta.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about Henrietta being seen as this Kentucky princess, and it sounds like in addition to her own charms, which were considerable, that rather than be denigrated as some sort of person from Dixie, that it elevated her a bit from the sounds of it.
Yes, a little on both sides. I mean, the English were then, and some, at least certainly in the crowd she was running in, were very critical of the racism that was still flowing heavily through the country then and through the South especially, and we're aware of that. And for instance, Henrietta's father was once asked when these terrible lynchings would stop, because this was a terrible period of racial violence in the teens and early 20s, and the KKK was resurgent. And he said to this woman in London, well, that would stop when Negroes stopped raping white women and girls. So that is the attitude that Henrietta inherited from her family. She did not stay in that place, and she embraced extremely closely not only the music that was becoming an artistic phenomenon, a real revolution in art, the jazz and blues that was coming out of African-American communities, but also the individuals who were doing the performing. And I wish, I mean, in all the research I did, and I can tell a lot more about it, The one that I just couldn't, it's just not written down, is the amount of time she spent listening to and engaging with the people who were making this amazing music. And we're talking about Count Basie and Bessie Smith and Florence Mills and Fats Waller. I mean, these are the people who changed the sense of what music was.
And the fact that it's really interesting that a person of her time and from her place would not see the boundaries. I mean, in sexuality, in race, in music. I mean, you mentioned the mandolin. She played the saxophone, too, didn't she?
Yes. And I found among her father's files the actual receipt from the piano. It was called the Crossgill Piano Company on downtown Louisville, sent to him for the saxophone she bought. And she taught herself to play. It was absolutely not okay for a respectable debutante to be blowing on a horn like that. It was considered basically sexual. I mean, you just didn't do it. And there, in the 20s, there began to be some novelty, you know, girl bands. And the reason they were so novelty, but this wasn't until the later 20s, and she got this in the teens. The reason it was so wild was that, oh my gosh, see those women blow those horns.
That's pretty wild stuff. Henrietta Bingham is the titled person in the book Irrepressible by Emily Bingham. Emily's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. How much of Henrietta's own writing survives, Emily?
So this is one of the real challenges that faced me when I first went to my editor and said, I think I might want to explore a book on this great aunt. And he said, well, what did she leave? And I said, nothing. And he said, well, let's find you something else. But what was left of hers were, well, my aunt cleaned out her apartment in New York when she died, and there were some stock market reports of her holdings, some dog kennel club registrations. She was a great animal lover. There were a lot of small photographs, almost all of them unidentified. And there was one letter from a woman that it wasn't clear who it was, but it was clearly it seemed to me that it was from a lover. Now, that letter proved to be from the tennis player Helen Hull Jacobs, a Californian who was top of her game in the early 30s, and I was able eventually to find out much more. The other thing that Henrietta left, and ironically, I'd been to all the way to California, all the way to London and north, south, beyond, looking at archives before I looked carefully in my own family home. And so this is one of the great stories of the research, was that my father, before he died, wasn't too wild about the Henrietta Project, but he was a man of great heart, and he said, you know, you might want to look up in the attic. I think there's an old trunk of hers there. Not much in it, but since you're interested. And I did take a peek, and it was a lot of old clothes, but it was really another couple of years before I went and really looked carefully. And it was a January day, cold, house wasn't being lived in, one light hanging above me, and I sat there all day with my yellow pad just listing. And I saw things that were interesting, especially some clothes that had monograms on them. And one of these was a tennis outfit that had the monogram HHJ, and that was Helen Hull Jacobs.
Wow, this really was archaeology.
This was a trunk that had been packed in 1937. There were newspapers from London lining it. Henrietta's father had been ambassador in the 30s under Roosevelt to London. And she had been packing up and bringing things back home. And apparently this trunk just never got fully unpacked. So those clothes, well, I learned that Helen Jacobs was the first woman to wear shorts in a major tournament. She broke that line. And I thought, these clothes don't belong in a trunk in Kentucky. They should be in the Tennis Hall of Fame. And so they went there. I sent them off. And the archivist later, or the curator later, got in touch with me to thank me and said that those would be a nice addition to their Helen Hull Jacobs collection. And little did that person know I was wanting to write a book, and I said, "What collection?" And off I went to find an amazing set of diaries, scrapbooks, photo albums with Henrietta written through them. So this was another case, as in Bloomsbury, where I wasn't reading Henrietta's own words, but I was reading her written through the hearts and bodies and, you know, minds of the people who loved her. And it added a great deal. She and Helen had about a 7-year relationship, and it went so far as that Helen was invited to live in the embassy with Henrietta. Henrietta watched her win Wimbledon, watched her runner up on Wimbledon, kept score on little cards, which I found later, and on which she also wrote the menu for that night.
Wow. It really is a sleuthing game, but moving on from one thing to the other. But, boy, just little by little, you illuminate the room that was the life of Henrietta Bingham. It's told in the story Irrepressible, the book by Emily Bingham. The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham is the subtitle. We'll come back and talk more with Emily about Henrietta and try not to get our Binghams confused. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with Emily Bingham and you in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Emily Bingham, a writer, a teacher, an author several times over. She's written a book about her great aunt, Henrietta Bingham, and the book is called Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham, who was bisexual, a libertine, an intellectual, a musician, and so much more, and one of the people who really truly made the Roaring Twenties roar. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Henrietta with Emily, 800-838-3760 around the region, by email jx@jeffnet.org. Haven't talked about her childhood at all at this point, and the family into which she was born had some tensions. Explain the mom, dad, and grandma situation that she was born into?
So Henrietta's father was a North Carolinian, and his family had been running for generations, since the late 1700s, a boarding school in North Carolina that was set up to basically prepare boys to go to Chapel Hill and beyond. Some went on to Princeton and places like that. It was a military boarding school by the time he was born in the years after the Civil War. And so he grew up in Asheville being expected, basically, to take this over from his father. And that wasn't really what Robert Worth Bingham wanted to do. He had higher hopes for something more illustrious than being a respected educator in the state of North Carolina. And he ended up meeting and marrying the daughter of a very successful industrialist, or granddaughter, really, of an industrialist from Kentucky, from Louisville, named Babes Miller. And she was in Asheville because her father had been ill. And, in fact, it was their relationship really took off right after the news spread through Asheville, North Carolina, then sort of a resort town, that Babes Miller's father, who had been seeking treatment there, had stepped in front of a train. And Babes was watching that, or riding that train. He was waiting for her and had to witness her father's death. And that's when Robert Worth Bingham stepped up and said, "I'm here for you." And she eventually got him back to Louisville with her, and he began working as a lawyer. But it was slow going. He wanted to be a politician. He ran for office a number of times. He complained that the corruption and the party, the boss machine politics in Louisville really made it almost impossible. He eventually was made mayor as an interim mayor when the whole election of 1907 was thrown out because of the corruption in the voting, and he was appointed to the position. But he was not reelected the next time an election came around. And so I think he was sort of frustrated in his ambitions in that realm. And it was not too long after that that his wife, Babes, Henrietta's mother, was killed in a violent, you know, sudden accident, again with a train, where the car she was riding in with her children was crossing tracks, and an interurban came and struck it. And so Henrietta witnessed that death, just as Babes had witnessed her father's death. And it was a big wound. And I think her father had depended on Babes for a great deal of emotional support, and I believe he trained that need on his adolescent daughter.
So it was a real supportive kind of relationship, but almost a spousal kind of relationship, the way you describe it.
Yes, and all families where there's a great loss can create, are trying to circle the wagons and protect each other. But in this case, I think it's just the timing and the particular personality that Robert Worth Bingham had and his need for feminine comfort pushed this a little beyond the boundaries of even, a father just trying to take, comfort from his daughter. He needed her too much, I would say. And on the other hand, so he really brought her in and made her sort of his, I don't know how far it went, but certainly he spoiled her, he wanted her near him, and in ways that you might spoil a woman as well. And it wasn't until a couple of years later that she was sort of pushed away again because he found somebody new, and that new person happened to be the richest woman in America.
Mrs. Flagler.
Yes, so Mrs. Flagler had North Carolina roots as well and actually had known Henrietta's dad growing up. And she was also recently widowed. She lost her husband, who was one of the great fortune makers of the Gilded Age, Henry Flagler. She was a much younger wife to him, and he had built Great House Whitehall for her in Florida, Palm Beach, as a wedding present. I mean, this woman was living a level of wealth because of his Standard Oil money and development of Florida that was just almost inconceivable. And, in some ways it seemed like a great match. They got married in 1916, and she came to live in Louisville, and they were sort of starting to set up their life there. Henrietta was brought home from boarding school to meet this new woman, wasn't invited to the wedding. And there's a great scene in the same hotel where the Great Gatsby put Daisy Buchanan's wedding, actually, the Seelbach.
Wow.
Where Mary Lilly was staying, because there was really no house good enough for her. She was in the best suite in the hotel. And she invited the children, these stepchildren, up to meet her and had presents from New York all ready for them for Christmas. And Henrietta reportedly came into the room and glared at her. And Henrietta had a way of looking at people that was reported widely among people she knew. But she looked at her and just started destroying the place, pushing all the boxes off the vanity in the bed and so forth, and Jen just ran out of the room. And so things did not get off to a good start.
No, not the best behavior for a 15-year-old either.
No. And then to make matters even more complicated, it was only 6 months later that Mary Lilly herself died. And the circumstances of that death, she was only in her early 50s, were so cloudy, and it was also such a surprise to the family of Mary Lilly that she had decided to leave Robert Worth Bingham a large bequest of $5 million when their prenuptial said that there wouldn't be any, that some of the members of her family suspected some foul play on Henrietta's father's part. And this was just an unbelievable strike against his honor as a Southern gentleman. And he weathered that, but it was headlines all over the country, and it got worse before it got better. All I can say is that these two blows to his ego and his support made him turn to his daughter in a way that I think never really lifted.
So definitely some trials and tribulations within the family as Henrietta was growing up. She did get off to college. It certainly had to be a good one. She ended up at Smith, and there she met Mina. Was it Kirstein?
Kirstein, yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, Minna Kirstein had gone to Smith herself. She was now a first-time professor teaching English, a extremely intelligent, great intellectual, really. But here she was getting a chance to teach at her alma mater, and who is in her first class that she's ever taught but this dazzlingly beautiful, pale-skinned, purple-eyed...
Tall, too, wasn't she?
And very tall for her time, over 5'8", which is extraordinary for that time. And she, well, it didn't take long. Minna and Henrietta began an affair. And it was that winter at some point at the Waldorf Astoria where Henrietta was staying with her father. This would be 1920. And Minna was visiting New York and came to see her, and she writes that it was then that Henrietta made love to me, and in such a way that I had to admit that I was in love with her as well as she being in love with me. And it was really Minna who took Henrietta away from Smith after she was having some trouble with her academic life. She wasn't passing some of her science courses and so forth, though she did very well in other classes. And I think she really was asked to leave the school. She was called by the administration a detriment to the community. So Minna gets a sabbatical, and where do they go? They go off to Europe, spend some time traveling France and Italy, and then they're going to spend the winter in London taking classes. But Minna decides that a homosexual relationship with this woman, as dazzling as she was, and alluring as she was, just there was no future in it, and she needed to stop the sexual aspect of their relationship. So she had an idea.
And that involved Sigmund Freud, I understand?
That did. So Minna, like many in the early 20s, was under the sort of, you know, spellbound by these new theories coming out of Vienna and a small group of others who were spreading Sigmund Freud's ideas about about how we mature, how we get off track, what causes us to have mental illness, what makes the world go wrong, as in World War I, where millions of people died for what felt like nothing. And Freud seemed to have answers for a lot of this. And he also said it was important and okay to look at our sexual feelings, that those were central to who we were and they drove our development of our personality.
So in a sense, Minna was trying to cure Henrietta?
She thought that if Henrietta could just go see a very good psychoanalyst, and she got someone's name and wrote him a letter, described the case, explained how brilliant this child, not really child by this time, was, young woman was, and said to Ernest Jones in London, "We're coming to London. Would you please see her? She has anxiety, she has panic attacks, and there's this thing about homosexuality that just isn't a go." And eventually, Henrietta winds up on the couch with Ernest Jones. He was a leading figure in the movement at the time, and he wrote to Minna that he was excited to bring Henrietta from women to men, and lucky the man will be who gets her because of her deep wells of charm and delight.
Well, because of those deep wells of charm and delight, I mean, we talked about John Houseman earlier, Helen Hull Jacobs, Minna Kirstein, Stephen Tomlin is also mentioned in the book, who really wanted to marry her. How did Henrietta generally return the rapt attentions of lovers?
Well, it seems that at least for a time, she returned them enough to keep them interested for long periods. But Stephen Tomlin was one of the ones who said early on, they were separated and he was writing letters to her. He said, "You got me to my knees at the beginning and there was really no hope for any change in my position." And I don't think he meant that in a cruel way, that she was sadistic about it, but simply that she had the upper hand in that relationship. And I think that was true in several other cases at least. So there was this sense that she, unlike most women in relationships in that time, where the man, I think the man was seen to be the one more in control, more in pursuit. She could be in pursuit and she could be in control, and that was startling.
Ultimately, we certainly get the feeling from reading the book that we wish we'd known Henrietta Bingham, or certainly wish we'd known of her, certainly before now. I can imagine this is a feeling you have in spades from having researched this.
Absolutely. I mean, if I could, really know her, obviously if I could sit her down, any biographer has a long list of questions
right.
that they would like to ask. I would have liked to ask her what she really thought of Ernest Jones. All the information I have is about and psychoanalysis and what he was doing with her and did it help? And, all the information I have is of others who were thinking about, what she should do and her own desire, her own impulses on that point are not exactly clear. She had male lovers who she had long relationships with, not endless, but, serious relationships, some of which, in John Houseman's case, it was a relationship from the 20s, but they revisited it in the 30s and even in the 40s. So this was not a, fly-by-night thing for her to be with men.
No, but certainly a fascinating book, Irrepressible, The Jazz Age Life of Henrietta Bingham, worth a read. Emily Bingham, her great niece, wrote it. Emily, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for giving me a chance to introduce Henrietta to you.
You bet. Take care.